And good afternoon, Blog Talk
Radio.
And good afternoon, Military Monday listeners. My name is John Gresham, and it is a snowy, wet, nasty day in Fairfax, Virginia, sort of like the way it can be here in the D.C. metro area. We're here to go ahead and talk about military matters, and today I think we've got a guest that you're going to enjoy. His name is Bob Doerr. He is a well-known author and journalist, particularly on matters regarding air power and the U.S. Air Force. I should say that Bob has been a friend of mine for a better part of 20-some-odd years, and I wanted to bring him on today to go and talk a little bit about the state of the U.S. Air Force, where it is, where it's been, where it might be going, and some of the more structural aspects of it. We'll also have a chance to talk to Bob about his own recent writing adventures, which include a number of books and quite a lot of other writing for other organizations. So without further ado, are you there, Bob?
Hello, John.
Hello, Bob. It's good to have you with us here. I should make note that...
Lovely snowy afternoon in Fairfax, Virginia.
I should make the note that Bob lives all of about 250 yards from me, but we're using the better part of $1 trillion of communications infrastructure to do this. So if you want to appreciate the absurdity of the situation, please enjoy.
Well, Bob, John, we're going to talk about the Air Force. And
yes, we are.
Some people will recognize me as Bob Doerr, and some people will recognize me as Robert F. Doerr.
Well, I'm just going to call you Bob because that's what I've always called you. And let's start out by asking a simple question with probably not a simple answer. What is the U.S. Air Force today? Can you describe it shortly as the state of the Air Force?
If you think about the importance of the Air Force and of air power to the nation, you need to think that today's Air Force in today's all-volunteer professional soldier era has been involved in some kind of conflict continuously for almost a quarter of a century. Even though defense spending has gone up since 2001 every year, the Air Force today is flying equipment that is older than at any previous point in its history. The men and women of the Air Force are exhausted. They've been deployed constantly. They've been to Iraq. They've been to Afghanistan again and again. Almost like the movie Groundhog Day, where you relive the same experience over and over.
As an example,
they're exhausted.
Bob,
they're using an infrastructure that is out of date. Go ahead.
As an example of this, I noted today that the last of the C-130E models, which date back to about the time I was being born back in the 50s, is just now being retired today down at Herbert Field, right?
Yes, indeed. Some of those have 1962 serial numbers.
Amazing. Please continue, Bob, what you were going with.
Well, I think the ordinary citizen on the street probably thinks that the military is living pretty well because defense budgets have gone up every year since 2001, and you see pictures of these new modern items of equipment like the F-22 Raptor and the C-17 Transport. But the fact is that the Air Force is old and tired and exhausted, and we're one of the burdens on the Air Force today is that we have far too many bases for the force structure that we have, and it's impossible to close a base in the United States. It's politically impossible to do that. I was sitting in the office of the chief of staff in 2007. At the time, it was General Michael Mosley, known as Buzz. He said to me, Bob, one of my staff members just came in here and told me that I'm in charge of the smallest American Air Force since Pearl Harbor, about 316,000 people. So there are a lot of challenges facing the Air Force if it's going to be prepared, particularly for the administration's pivot toward Asia, for the new emphasis that we're placing on the importance of China, for the new dangers that we're seeing and possible threats from Iran and North Korea. Those are our threats of what is known as peer warfare, P-E-E-R, warfare. That is conflict between modern nation states.
Not the asymmetrical stuff we think of so much these days,
right,
since 9/11. Right.
Not counterinsurgency, not the Taliban, not Afghanistan.
These are people who can actually shoot back and potentially hurt us.
Indeed.
Okay, which takes us to the next question I have for you, which is, what do you hear from around the Air Force? I mean, one of the things that's a hallmark of your reporting with various media organizations is that you very much talk to airmen. You talk to people around the Air Force community, from the chief of staff down to the line doggies who are turning the wrenches and loading the bombs. What is it you've been hearing of late?
Yes,
about
I
the
do,
state of
John.
The Air Force?
I do that. I do that in part because I write a weekly column for Air Force Times newspaper, and I try to talk to the captains and the staff sergeants of the Air Force out there who are doing the real job out there on the pavement, where it's hot and crowded and difficult. And what I hear is basically what I began with. We need a rest. We need a reboot. We need to start over again. We need some newer equipment. We need more what is known in the military as dwell time. That's time that can be spent at home with family before going off to the next deployment. And we need to do something about the aging of the airplanes and the equipment and the buildings and the plumbing and the electricity and the water and the Air Force.
Does this include organizations? I mean, we've been fighting, as you say, through that quarter century, very much on the business model left to us by a wonderful friend and leader, Wilbur Creech, who was the very last commander of TAC, one of the last commanders of the Tactical Air Command, who had this idea for the monolithic wing, which he brought into service in the late 70s and early 80s. Is it time to start looking at new kinds of organizations and units for the post-Cold War era, finally, a quarter century after the Cold War?
Well, I greatly admire Bill Creech. I liked him a lot and give him credit for many things, including a role in encouraging the F-15E Strike Eagle, which is one of the premier combat aircraft in our inventory today. I don't think, John, that this is the time to be reinventing the wheel. I don't think this is the time to reorganize. I think this is the time for a long, hard look at how we can take a break, particularly with hostilities, we hope, winding down in Afghanistan, take a break and reboot and restore some resilience to the force and get some new equipment.
Talk a little bit about the people. You know, there's a lot of jokes that are made regarding how the Air Force treats its deployed personnel, you know, in a very pampered manner. But the fact of the matter is, being an expeditionary airman is not a vacation. It's hard work. It's a lot of hard work in a dirty, dangerous, noisy, and sometimes downright hostile environment. What kind of shape is that force of people in right now? And when I say that, I mean, how tired are they? How depleted are they? How are they doing with promotions, schools, and other things which allow them to have something approaching a balanced career? What is the state of the people in the force right now?
Your deployed expeditionary airman who is away from home in a trouble spot or a war zone is facing a mixed situation. On the one hand, this has just been going on too long and there's been too little respite and we need a break and we need a rest. On the other hand, when you're deployed into a real world situation, you dispense with a lot of the bureaucratic baloney that is burdening airmen in their stateside assignments, and you focus on the mission. I was talking a couple of days ago to Lieutenant Colonel Jay Sabia, known as Fang. He is the F-16 pilot who is the commander of the 4th Expeditionary Fighter Squadron, normally stationed at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, but currently at Kunsan in Korea, where they have taken 12 aircraft and 230 people to bolster the 8th Fighter Wing at Kunsan, the Wolfpack. And they are very much aware of the North Korean threat that lies just a few minutes flying time north of them. And they are doing a real-world mission. So even though they are in an isolated spot where there are no families at all and very few creature comforts, they are committed to what they're doing. And, you know, God bless them. We're very fortunate to have people like this, particularly considering how difficult we make life for them. But people like Fang, Jay Sabia, need a break. And they will be the first to tell you that they're doing the best they can with what they have. In the case of the officer I'm talking about, what he has is an F-16CM Block 40 Fighting Falcon, a fighter that dates to 1974, then upgraded with new equipment with helmet-mounted queuing sight and Link 16 data link and other new systems. But, you know, they're starting to find cracks in the wings. They're starting to find corrosion in the airplanes. And, you know, at Kunsan Air Base, they need a new runway. The runway there is 50 years old, and during the thaw in the spring, after the winter, the runway has cracks that have to be repaired. And that's just sort of an allegory for the Air Force as a whole. It's old and it's tired, even though it's very capable and the people are very committed.
Literally pothole season for the Air Force all over the world.
And if I could, John, since I do write about airmen all day, every day, I'd like to tell people how to call me on the phone.
Bob, we know that you like to talk to people. We know you like to gather information straight from the horse's mouth, as it were. Please, go ahead.
Bob Doerr, my phone number is 703-264-8950. If you're listening to this and you're interested in this subject, call me, please.
And I will tell you, Bob loves to talk to people because, as I have learned, you get it from people. You don't necessarily read it on the Internet.
I'm going to suggest that you let me say a quick word about life for the airman who's at home, who's not deployed.
Because they have their own set of problems these days.
They have a lot of frustrations. Let me tell you that they are very happy with their new leader, the current chief of staff, General Mark Welch, who incidentally happens to be the only chief of staff in many decades that I haven't met personally, although I exchange emails with him. He is very highly regarded and seen as somebody who will speak truth to power, and he's seen as somebody who cares about the troops and their families and morale and welfare. And so that's a very positive thing. But I got to tell you that there's a lot of negative grumbling going on among the staff sergeants and the captains of the Air Force. There are some universally despised things, like such as the emphasis on physical training, PT, which is being used indirectly as a means to force people out of the service. The performance rating system, which is simply broken and needs to be totally overhauled. The general situation regarding facilities on bases, support for families, things of that nature. Remember, John, when I was in the Air Force in the 1950s, about 30% of the force was married. Today, about 78% of the Air Force is married, and some of them are married to each other.
Yes, indeed.
That creates challenges.
And now there's a new problem, something involving a given that everybody thought was always going to be there, tuition assistance.
Yes, indeed. That's a current issue.
And talk about that, because that's not just an Air Force thing. That's a joint thing across the entire force.
It is having a profound effect on morale, and it is only one of the results of the uncertainty that the troops are seeing coming from Washington, where they are seeing a government that is dysfunctional, a Congress that cannot pass a budget, two political parties that are so much at loggerheads with each other that they can't negotiate an agreement on anything.
Where having dinner or lunch is the top news item of the day.
Yes. And for leaders in the Air Force, even sort of, you know, middle grade leaders like your lieutenant colonel, who's a squadron commander, it's very difficult to make any sort of plans when you don't know whether the government is going to shut down on March 27th when the continuing resolution comes to an end. You don't know what's going to happen with sequestration, continuing resolution, fiscal year budget, debt ceiling, all these other things that our leaders in Washington are supposed to resolve for us. And there's never been a time of greater uncertainty about these things than there is today.
And what does this mean in terms of, if you're the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Welch, who you just mentioned a few minutes ago, and you have a talented, gifted, even brilliant staff of bureaucrats ready to work for you, but normal is living under a continuing resolution, and none of them have seen a finished budget in 5 years. What is that like in your mind for them?
Well, it's like the snowball that gets bigger as it rolls downhill. It gets worse every day, and we've never really quite been exactly where we are today, John. We don't. Our leaders, the leaders who work for General Welch in the Pentagon and in the Air Force commands around the world don't know how to make plans. They don't know what to tell their troops. There is considerable talk of furloughs of, if not military members, at least unpaid furloughs of civilian employees in the Air Force who make up about 200,000 people and are very important to the Air Force's mission. And it's just the uncertainty that is very painful. And
I recently did an interview with the Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps for Programs and Plans, who informed me that in the 3 years he had been at the Pentagon in that position, he had never not operated under a continuing resolution. And when I said, "Is this your new normal?" he just looked at me and said, "Yeah, we all expect to go and never see a finished budget anytime
yes,
in the next
yeah,
3 to 4 years."
Yeah, that's true, John. And yet every year, the military services prepare planning for a budget proposal to be submitted to Congress by the executive branch. And a lot of work goes into that, and very often it doesn't lead anywhere.
Agreed. And by the way, to our listeners, if you want to call in and ask Bob or myself a question, please call area code 347-945-7246, and we'll be happy to talk to you. Bob, you talked about, you know, we've talked about the finance aspects. We've talked a little about the people, particularly young people who are serving in the Air Force. Let's talk about the hardware aspects of it. Right now, the Air Force has the oldest average fleet age across the various types of aircraft they fly of any time in their history. I mean, you've got F-15s that are approaching their 35th year since they were produced off the line in St. Louis. We were talking earlier about the last of the C-130E models that are being retired this very day down at Hurlburt Field, which date back to the Cuban Missile Crisis for their production dates. What are we needing to buy to go and make some dents in this aging fleet problem?
Well, we're facing some very difficult decisions, and it's difficult to see all of them because we've got this giant elephant in the room that is blocking our vision. And the giant elephant in the room is the F-35 Lightning II Joint Strike Fighter, called the F-35 or the JSF.
Now, for our listeners who are not aware of it, the JSF program is designed to produce a joint strike fighter to replace a wide variety of airframes, including the F-16, the F-18, the AV-8B Harrier, as well as some others from overseas. It was designed to be stealthy. It is designed to have very strong qualities in terms of networking between aircraft and out to offboard information sources. But by the same token, it's also a horse designed by a committee, which is a fancy word for a camel. So, Bob, please go on and explain further.
Yes, the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, is all things to all men. It's a jack of all trades. It's in the U.S. services, we want almost 2,500 of them to equip the Air Force, Marine Corps, and Navy. They're absolutely critical to the Marine Corps for its amphibious mission now. There's no plan B if the F-35 doesn't work. The Marine Corps has to have it. And yet, you know, it started out as what was meant to be a relatively low-cost advanced fighter, low-cost in contrast to the F-22 Raptor, production of which has now come to an end. And it is becoming the largest and costliest military program in U.S. history. There are 51 of these F-35 aircraft that are currently flying, or at least they would be flying if they weren't grounded, as they have been on several occasions in the last few months. They are doing something that really hasn't been done in recent years. They're doing something called concurrency. Concurrency is testing the aircraft at the same time you put it into service.
And certain aspects are still being designed concurrently with the test program. You literally
well,
using
indeed.
Input.
And some of them so far don't work. There are problems with all kinds of items of equipment that are essential to this aircraft, including the helmet-mounted cueing sight and the tail hook for the Navy version and several other items. And costs keep going up. Schedules keep getting moved to the right, and we are nowhere near having our first operational airplane ready to fly and fight. In fact, until very recently, the airplane known as the Lightning II was not allowed to fly within 25 miles of lightning. And this program is so big, and it has such a vast influence on the entire nation and on the Air Force, that either something needs to happen to get it right fast, or we need to start talking seriously about the alternatives. And I think some leaders in the Air Force, for the first time now, are talking about alternatives to the Joint Strike Fighter.
Now, for starters, let us say, not so much in the aircraft's defense as a matter of fact, the new program manager has indicated that there's going to be a complete restructuring of the program office and new personnel handling a number of the critical issues. And this is certainly an encouraging sign, obviously, that they at least recognize they do have problems. Can you make any comments regarding
that? One of the things that they need to fix right away, John, is they need a new public affairs office, because the Joint Strike Fighter program has the worst public affairs office that I've ever dealt with, and that's widely known and understood. And what that means is they're not succeeding at telling their story.
And as we both know, there are things that are working rather well on this aircraft. There are good things about it, correct?
That long pause you hear is your guest on this program today, me, Bob Doerr, thinking about trying to find something good to say about the Joint Strike Fighter.
Well,
and I don't know how much time our listeners have, but...
I would point out that many of the subsystems are doing rather well. The sensor system is obviously coming along nicely. Generally speaking, while they're having some problems with the engine itself is, as a core technology, is generally a pretty good engine, all things considered. But as you say, there's a lot of integration problems. When you talk about alternatives to the F-35, what are the alternatives at this point in your mind?
Well, first, if I may, John, let me just say one more word about concurrency and a lesson that we could learn from World War II, because
mm-hmm.
As you know, I'm the author of a book called Mission to Tokyo.
Which is about the B-29 campaign against Japan during World War II.
Yeah, that's, again, I'm Bob Doerr, and the book is Mission to Tokyo, and it deals with the B-29 bomber of World War II. And although they didn't use the term at the time, they were, in effect, doing concurrency then, the same concurrency that they speak about today with the Joint Strike Fighter program. They were still ironing out the technical issues with the aircraft while they were placing it into service and into operation and indeed into combat. And we paid a very high price for doing it that way. The B-29 had a pivotal role in the war against Japan, as I write about in my book, Mission to Tokyo. But it was not perfected, and more Americans died from engine fires on B-29s than from Japanese gunfire. So there are arguments that concurrency, which is what we're doing today with the Joint Strike Fighter, may not be a good idea.
Okay, and it needs to be said that part of the reason for the push for the bird was, one, that Hap Arnold, the chief of the Army Air Force, was personally invested in this particular aircraft and its technology, and two, off to the side, way out of sight, but nevertheless in the background, was a little thing called the Manhattan Program that eventually would produce a bomb the B-29 would carry to help end World War II. So there were legitimate reasons for pushing, but, and I'd like you to fill in the line after the but and the comma.
Well, I'm thinking of General LeMay, Curtis LeMay, a famous Air Force figure who was in command of the B-29 forces on the island of Guam in 1945.
Not a subtle or soft man by anybody's standards.
No, not at all. And while I have the thought in mind, let me mention that I'm also thinking about a 13-year-old Japanese girl in Tokyo who witnessed the bombing that the B-29s inflicted. And so my book, Mission to Tokyo, is the only book in which you can read about Curtis LeMay and Yoko Ono in the same sentence.
Really?
But
okay.
LeMay is given this new B-29 bomber that has not really been fully tested or has not fully matured and is not really fully ready for combat, although it is the most advanced military aircraft in the world. It's pressurized. It can drop bombs from 30,000 feet.
It can fly 3,000 miles. It's an
indeed
incredible aircraft.
And so there are a lot of good things to say about it, but I think some experts will tell you that they probably would not have proceeded with the B-29 if we had not had the urgency of war at the time. And yes, we're at war now also, but I'm not sure that fielding the Joint Strike Fighter and delivering it to operational units before it's ready to be operational is really a very good idea.
Okay,
and I'd like to just mention one more time, if I could, that I'd love to hear from anybody on the phone that might want to call me. I'm Bob Doerr. My telephone number is 703-264 8950. I'm the author of Mission to Tokyo, and I study the Joint Strike Fighter a lot. In fact, I have an article about it coming out in Flight Journal magazine this week.
Now, this is what's going on with just one airframe that the Air Force badly needs to go and replace a bunch of their airplanes with.
Well, let's see if we can look around that big elephant. And you know, if you talk to General Welsh.
Okay, that's one airplane. What else do we need to replace?
If you talk to General Welsh about his priorities, he would say that his first priority is a new bomber.
Now, when we say a bomber, we're talking big thing, carries lots of payload very far, and, oh, by the way, does have a piece of the nuclear mission.
Absolutely, and the current thinking is that this would be something like the bombers that we're familiar with, a modern-day version of the B-52, if you will. It would also be a platform that could be used for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or ISR, and it would have other capabilities, but it would be a traditional bomber.
And the first question, which is kind of an odd one that we ask now, is does it have men in it when it flies these missions?
Yes. I think.
But you had to think
now,
about that.
The thinking now on the part of the Air Force leadership and of people generally is that it would be manned. There is a school of thought that we are entering the age of the unmanned aerial vehicle, the UAV, which the Air Force prefers to call remotely piloted aircraft, or RPAs, and which most of the world calls drones. And so we could have a debate as to whether drones are going to replace all kinds of manned aircraft, or whether drones are simply a fashion or a fad that will pass. And I don't know the answer to that one, John.
Do you have thoughts on that? In other words, if you had, for example, if you had a RPA that had the capabilities of the Joint Strike Fighter, say the A model, which the Air Force is going to fly, but could go ahead and operate without a pilot on board and was perhaps, say, 50% cheaper, would that be of interest to you in your mind and the minds of people out there in the Air Force?
Well, if you're looking into the mind of Bob Dorr, the answer is that I would prefer to spend that money on an advanced version of the F-15K Slam Eagle or the F-16E/F Desert Falcon and get the newest and latest version of those current fighter and fighter-bomber aircraft with the latest technology on the inside and spend the money on that rather than on a new unmanned vehicle. And I think that there is some consideration being given today to doing exactly that.
What you're talking about is a legacy airframe updated, obviously, and given some stealthing, but with state-of-the-art systems and sensors on board, correct?
Yes, and it would be new build, yes.
Which is a big deal because we've got airframes out there that are how old these days? I mean,
well,
the average age
in the Air Force is 23 and a half years. Remember that the planes we used in World War II lasted 5 to 10 years. We have aircraft today that are the average 23 and a half years, but that we have some aircraft that are 40 to 50 years old.
Okay, and let's take this thought. When a pilot graduates college and goes to basic flight training these days, how old are they in the Air Force?
They tend to be a great deal older than they were in the past. In World War II, you could have an entire 10-man bomber crew on or 11-man bomber crew on the B-29 that I described in my book Mission to Tokyo and not have a single member of that crew who was 21 years old. But today,
but it's
that
safe to say that the age of the aircraft that we are dealing with these days, on average, and the age of the new air crews is roughly in the same ballpark. They're 20 plus years old.
If you take the average, yes. But if you talk about some of the older aircraft, like the KC-135 tanker or the B-52 bomber, you could easily have a pilot of that aircraft today whose grandfather was a pilot of that aircraft.
Yes, and that is apparently not an uncommon thing.
I think, again, John, that we should look around the elephant in the room, the big, costly, controversial, trouble-prone, delayed joint strike fighter. We should look around that and look at some of the other needs. One of those is the new tanker, the KC-46. That's the one that General Welch lists as his second priority.
Now, this is the one that has gone through a torturous competition to get to the point where it is now, and it's basically a converted 767, correct?
I think we should talk about that torturous process a little bit. Yes, the KC-46.
Then please do. Explain when somebody got the bright idea that, hey, we need to start replacing these aged KC-135s that date back to the late 1950s and put something new on the ramp.
Well, let me make an important point, if I may, because this relates to the morale of the staff sergeants and captains that I worry about so much. We've both said some very good things about our flag officers and our leaders and the chief of staff, and they are good people. They're excellent leaders. But we also have some who are perceived as not being any of those things. And there is a general feeling among the lower-ranking troops in the military today that too many of our generals and admirals see their top-ranking positions as being simply a temporary waypoint, a temporary stopover on their way toward a lucrative job in the aerospace industry. And back in the day, John, back in the past that you and I remember so well, an American general would never have considered lowering himself to working for the companies that make the rifles and the tanks and the ships and the planes that are used by American troops. That would have been beneath his dignity. Can you imagine George C. Marshall even considering anything like that? Retired generals did take jobs in the past. You know, General Eisenhower became president of Columbia University. General Lucius Clay became the president of Continental Can. There were good jobs available for retired generals, but they didn't typically go to work for aerospace companies.
Not going through the revolving door and essentially showing back up wearing an ill-fitting business suit and flacking
ill-fitting indeed, John. And I think
ill-fitting suit and flacking
door
for the very people for whom they were customers just a few weeks earlier.
You can tell your listeners that Bob Dorr says, "Close that door. Close that revolving door. Have a rule against it." Keep
a minimum of 5 years, I would
keep
say.
Keep industry and the military separate. The system that has evolved that we have today, with industry having so much influence and K Street lobbyists having so much influence, that's why we have defense budgets that are larger than ever, and yet we have exhausted troops and ancient equipment.
And let's include in that tanker question also the fact that we continue to have to buy replacement theater and heavy transports because we never stop using those resources. The drones we bought in the first generation were not built to Air Force specifications. In many cases, they were almost commercial off the shelf, and they do not have the service lives of an F-16 or an F-15 designed to last three decades. I mean, what other holes in the in that, what other pieces of that elephant are big that need to be looked at in the near term?
Ever since 1964, up until relatively recently, every new Air Force pilot got his advanced flight training in the cockpit of the T-38 Talon, a supersonic jet trainer that was...
Beautiful airplane.
The first and possibly the only supersonic jet trainer, originally painted white, and troops called it the White Rocket. And until relatively recently, every pilot trained in that aircraft, even pilots who went on to fly heavy multi-engine cargo planes. So for many of them, the T-38 was the most advanced aircraft they ever flew. Well, it's a great airplane, but it's really, really tired. They've got 16,000 hours on the airframe that was designed for 8. They've been through a very good upgrade program to bring them all to T-38C, as in Charlie standard. And they're good airplanes, but we have had a program called TX on the books for several years that is intended to replace the T-38, and there's no money for it.
Because the last thing anybody wants to buy is a new trainer, obviously.
No, the last thing anybody wants to buy is a replacement for the UH-1N Twin Huey helicopter.
Yes.
The Air Force has 63 of those. They have two extremely important missions. One of them is to provide the ground security for our intercontinental ballistic missile sites in the American heartland. And the other important mission is to be available at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland to evacuate government leaders in an emergency.
The continuity of government program, yes.
Yeah, the continuity of government program. And the UH-1N Huey helicopter, and those have typically 1968 serial numbers painted on the tail boom. It doesn't perform well in hot weather. It doesn't perform well at high altitude. It's limited.
Not real good in dusty, dirty environments.
Yes, that's right. And you know, it's a wonderful aircraft, and it's a late version of the original Huey, which is revolutionized aviation by combining the gas turbine engine with the rotary wing aircraft, you know, a turbine-powered helicopter.
But it was doing so, again, about the time I was being born.
Well, yes. Well, you were born a long time ago, John. So
and
I
love you
can,
too, Bob. Thank you.
That's true. And the Air Force has another program called Common Vertical Lift Support Platform, CVLSP, which would replace the Huey. But again, there is no money. It would be fairly easy to do, by the way. A lot of the mission that's performed by the Huey could be performed by the UH-72 Lakota, which is being manufactured in Columbus, Mississippi by EADS North America. And there are some other candidates for that job. But as I said, there's no money.
All right, and let's take another switch now, and let's talk about what the Air Force is going to be asked to do. Earlier on in the program, we talked about the fact that we've spent over a decade, almost a dozen years now, using the Air Force to play whack-a-mole with terrorists in a counterinsurgency mode. And don't get me wrong, I think that the Air Force has performed really great, and the people I know on the ground who are Marines, Air Force, combat controllers, and soldiers, there is nothing they love more than hearing the sound of an AC-130 or a Warthog over their head. But that isn't necessarily where the next fight's going to be. Talk a little bit about the next fight and what the Air Force is doing today to get ready for that probable next fight.
Well, I want to echo your sentiment that we are blessed with wonderful people who are doing hard work out there, doing the hard things that are difficult. And you can't give them enough credit because they represent only about 1 or 2% of the American population, and they are contributing so much to our country's interests. My opinion is that we went too far in the direction of fighting terrorists, doing counterinsurgency, emphasizing asymmetrical warfare, developing, and I blame most of this on Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who was Secretary from 2006 to 2011. He was a big fan of counterinsurgency. He was a big fan of drones. He was a big fan of small systems such as the MC-12W Project Liberty reconnaissance aircraft, which is great in a counterinsurgency war. But all the time that's been going on, there have been very real nation states with very modern forces that have been improving and upgrading themselves. And I wouldn't want to mention that without mentioning Russia.
Who has not been sitting still. Just their surface-to-air missile family has become very formidable again.
We don't get up in the morning worrying about war with Russia, but I wonder how many Americans realize that the United States and Russia still have intercontinental ballistic missiles by the hundreds with nuclear warheads that are on what I would call hair trigger alert. They are on launch on warning status, and they can be launched on very short notice. And that's a big concern to me. I don't worry about war with Russia every day either. But if I had my choice, I would de-alert some of the missiles and arrange it so it would take longer to launch them. China, North Korea, Iran, who knows what other near-peer modern state could pose a threat to us. My own view is that I'm not as worried about Iran as our administration or our government. I am more worried about North Korea. North Korea has enormous potential to create trouble. And if you are going to confront that kind of an enemy, you need modern, robust, long-range land-based air power. You need big, complicated, heavy, costly systems. And you just can't do it with those little flivvers that we've been using in Afghanistan.
In other words, bombers. Fighter bombers armed with penetration weapons, precision guided, with outstanding ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance.
Absolutely,
to provide
John.
Targeting
yes.
for them. In other words, the things big air forces have and do.
A lot of what I believe today, John, was expressed in 1942 in the book Victory Through Air Power by Alexander Seversky. And I'd rather talk about my books than his. In fact, I think it's about time to do that. But he was in favor of long-range land-based air power, and he believed that that was the way that you win wars. And I believe that, the only way you can win a war of counterinsurgency is to be the insurgent, and that we should have learned that at Lexington and Concord. And I love the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Army, but I believe that the Air Force should be the dominant force. And if that's going to happen, we need money and we need bombers.
And I may have you back to argue that point with some supporters from those other joint services. One last thing regarding those peer near-term threats. We're slowly beginning to get indications that the Air Force has altered its basic training package away from counterinsurgency, more towards those traditional large target strike operations. And one of the reasons we know this is that we're seeing a lot of information coming out of the Fighter Weapons Center and the ranges at Nellis Air Force Base, where they're currently running one of the first red flags they've run in a long time, which really emphasize those kinds of things. I mean, we've got big bombers, we've got fighters from all over the world, including new RAF fighter bombers. Talk a little bit about what we've been hearing coming out of Nellis and what you think that might mean in terms of how we're getting ready to potentially deal with a North Korean or Iranian or Syrian threat.
Yes, not only the red flag exercise, which not all listeners may know is a realistic mock war type of exercise where you practice real world flying and fighting. Also exercises in Alaska and as far away as Singapore, where we cooperate with allies. The scenario is more and more geared toward fighting somebody like North Korea rather than fighting somebody like Al-Qaeda.
And so nation states are starting to be groovy targets again.
Indeed.
And with that, I'd like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about, you know, we've talked about a wide range of issues here, and one of the reasons I asked you on is that you do talk every day to airmen. You do talk every day to people in the contracting and aerospace world. Talk a little bit about what you've been focused on the past few months, what kind of projects you're working on, and what do you have that's coming out here in the near future?
I have wonderful opportunities for work, John, because I get to write about the present-day Air Force, and I also get to write about Air Force history. And again, for anybody who tuned in late, I'm Bob Doerr, D-O-R-R, Robert F. Doerr, and I'm the author of a book called Mission to Tokyo. And I'm going to mention my phone number in a minute and ask you to call me. But I write a weekly column for Air Force Times newspaper where I try to take the pulse of our airmen and report on what they're thinking. And they're very capable and they're very dedicated, but they're tired and they want new leadership. But I also write history, and I'm, you know, the book Mission to Tokyo is a history of the most destructive single bombing event in history, the day on the March 9th of 1945 when General LeMay launched 344 B-29 heavy bombers from three islands in the Marianas to bomb the Japanese capital at low level with incendiary bombs. Again, this will be the last time I'll plug it, the book Mission to Tokyo by Robert F. Doerr. Please call me on the phone, 703-264-8950.
And let us say right now that this event that Bob is talking about has the unusual distinction of being the most deadly bombing attack in the history of warfare. A lot of people would think that would have been Hiroshima or Nagasaki, which in fact were the second and third most deadly, but in fact the bombers of the 20th Bomb Command created a conflagration of a completely new and unique type called a tidal wave of fire, which essentially is a moving wall of fire moving at roughly, what, 60 miles an hour, Bob?
Yes, just really
And to this day, there's really no accurate count on the actual casualties of that night. They could be as high as 100,000, 150,000. The bodies just vaporized in the heat. And when it was all said and done, in one night we had burned out 16 square miles of downtown Tokyo. It was just an amazing raid and really was a benchmark in the history of warfare and mass destruction.
Right about that time, a nerdly-looking little captain gets off a transport plane at Guam and says, "Take me to see General LeMay." And everybody standing around him looks at him and laughs and says, "Oh, yeah, General LeMay receives little nerdly captains like you all the time. Why don't you bring your tambourine and you can go sing Kumbaya together? And your chances of getting to see the general are somewhere below zero." The captain reaches into his pocket and pulls out a letter from President Roosevelt. And pretty soon everybody is bowing and doing everything they can to help this young captain. And he goes into a room where he's alone with General LeMay and briefs General LeMay on a secret weapon that American scientists are developing in New Mexico.
And a little thing called the atomic bomb.
Because of his knowledge of that new secret weapon, General LeMay was not allowed to fly over enemy territory any longer, so he did not fly on the mission to Tokyo, that is the title of my book. But he was still in command when the 509th Composite Group arrived and began preparations for the atomic bombings of Japan.
Bob, I want to thank you for coming and joining me today, and I appreciate you sharing what you think. One thing we love here is brutal honesty, and God, I love it when we get that out, because you just don't hear it enough in the media these days.
It's a wonderful opportunity to talk about the Air Force. John, thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you, Bob, and hopefully we can have you back again sometime.
Let's do it.
All right. That was Bob Doerr of Fairfax, Virginia, who writes extensively about the U.S. Air Force, and I hope that you've enjoyed our little talk. Right now, we are planning to have next week as our guest another local author here in Northern Virginia, Larry Bond, who some of you may be familiar with for his novels, but is also very well known as a war game designer and an expert on crisis around the world. And pretty much speaking, if there's a crisis going on right now in the world, Larry has written about it, and I look forward to being able to put him on and let him speak to it. Again, if you want to go ahead and talk to us, you can go ahead and send me a tweet at GreshamJ01 on Twitter, at John Gresham at Facebook, and GreshamJ01 at Yahoo.com if you just want to send me an email. Thank you so much for your listening today, and we will be back next week for Military Monday. Goodbye.